Welcome to Turn the Page, the official podcast of the Syosset Public Library.
Hi, this is Jessica, and I'm here with...
This is Sharon.
Megan.
And?
Cody.
Cody, and we're here on Syosset Library, Turn the Page. And Cody, would you like to tell us why you're here today?
Sure. My name's Cody Merrick. I'm director, producer of a new documentary now available on VOD, and it's coming on DVD in July. It's called Scary Stories. It's a documentary, full-length documentary about scary stories to tell in the dark, which is a book series that many people remember very fondly. Were published between 1981 and 1991, so it's kind of a nostalgia title for a lot of people. Collection of short, scary stories for kids. It's also one of the most banned or challenged children's books of the last 40 years. So we touch on a lot of things. Certainly it's stories of urban legends and folklore. So we definitely delve into that. We also touch on the illustrations, which many people remember distinctly about the books. But also we talk a bit about censorship and a lot of things dealing with how we come to challenge books in America and in general. And so, we delve into a lot of different things.
When we started talking after we saw the documentary, I think that was one of the things that struck all of us was how much it was about
the censorship and about the whole process of when a book is challenged, what does a librarian do? I found that really interesting.
Yeah, as librarians, I think that really it spoke to all of us because I think we've all at least once had somebody.
Question.
I don't know.
We've had questions or, complaints or something. But, these books definitely, with the illustrations, I think that just struck a chord with a lot of parents that, maybe weren't so comfortable with their kids, getting scared.
Cody, when did you first encounter these books?
I'm like a lot of people. When the third book came out in 1991, I was 11 years old. So I definitely read these when I was a kid and, read a lot of Goosebumps, R.L. Stein's in the documentary and a lot of other, similar titles. And that's I definitely had a similar experience to a lot of people. Books like these were the ones that I started reading and started getting into reading at, that ideal age, ages 8 to 12, basically. And so similar to a lot of the people, though, I'm sure I moved on and I didn't think about them for maybe a decade. And then in my 20s, with the rise of the internet, people, nostalgically say, "Hey, remember these?" And yeah, of course, that sort of thing. And I re-remember them as an adult, like a lot of people. And then, when I kind of early on decided, this was 5 years ago, it's a long journey putting this documentary together. Early on, the idea was to kind of do a documentary about the importance of literacy, right? That was kind of the undercurrent, but typically what you want is some kind of, story to tell that delivers that idea, right? And so I thought of these books and it just gelled, right? There's all these different things that could be explored, but ultimately the end result is a message about, okay, at least we got kids reading, and the joke I sometimes make with these is, now we can look at how all these people who grew up with these books are now as adults, and most of the time they didn't turn out to be homicidal maniacs, you know. I mean, yes, they like scary things, you know, and then they moved on to read, you know, Stephen King or other scary books, and but they're now, you know, librarians, and they're now musicians and artists and all these things, you know. So it generally had a positive effect on them, not a negative one. And so so it starts to question, you know, why we, you know, take these books off the shelves altogether if these particular books are the most challenged and had a positive effect on a lot of people. You know, you start to question that sort of thing.
What about you, Sharon and Megan? When do you remember first?
Well, I mean, it's funny. After after Jessica told me we were doing the podcast, I did some digging in my house, and I actually found my own copy of Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark with my little handwriting in it that even says, like, if found, put in lost and found, because I was very concerned as a child of losing this book. So I definitely, you know, read it. It was a well-loved copy, and the images just really, they stuck with me. So, like, that, I think... I don't know. In my elementary school, we had a librarian who used to dress up for Halloween as like a fortune teller, and she made the library dark and mysterious, and we read scary stories, and that just like left such an indelible like mark on me that, you know, it was okay to read scary stories in school, and she really was into it. So I guess, you know, that was a different. Definitely a different approach than some of the stuff I saw in the documentary with, you know, these challenges and the superintendents and all that. But I just have such a strong memory of reading these books from, you know, back in the 80s and 90s. And so how about you, Megan? Do you remember?
So my first experience with these books was in second or third grade, and I completely devoured them. I loved how it combined folklore concepts. Mm-hmm. And as a young kid, I was just so curious about mm-hmm. reading about horror. And there weren't that many books I felt like available to me, but I credit my school library for providing the books and having them there because I love them.
Mm-hmm. I used to go on vacation to Lake George with my family, and every night, because there was no electricity where we went, my family would read from these books, and I was the biggest scaredy cat on the face of the planet. And sometimes I would be afraid to sit around the fire and listen, but then I'd end up in the cabin outside of where the fire is listening from the window. So, you know, I was like, in a way, it was like I was scared to listen to them, and the pictures definitely added something, because Steve Gamel, I mean, that he is so distinct.
Yeah, if you've seen the art, you know you can't ever forget.
Yes, but I grew to really just love them, and it got to me as a librarian that I started doing scary story programs at the end of the summer where I'd read from them to kids, and kids still love them. Mm-hmm. I would have them make s'mores with marshmallow fluff and chocolate frosting on graham crackers, and by the end of the night, like, none of the books were on our shelves again, because every child who came to that program either wanted one or wanted me to get one from somewhere else.
Yeah, those books really, it's just one of the things
I probably remembered more than anything, thinking back at these books. Yes, of course, I remember the illustrations, and at this point, I know the stories inside and out pretty much, but, you know, early on kind of remembering these books from childhood, I could probably pick out a couple of the stories and that sort of thing. But one of the things that stuck out to me was the source material, right?
Oh, yes.
You had Alvin Schwartz, who was kind of more a researcher than anything else. And so, you know, he did other books that dealt with folklore in different ways and stuff. He kind of, to some degree, stumbled on the idea, oh, kids love scary things. Well, let's let's collect only scary.
To be honest with you, I'm sorry to cut you off just really quickly. Like, one of his books that traumatized me the most wasn't even one of these. It was his the one for the younger children, In a Dark, Dark Room with the Green Ribbon story.
I heard that over and over again.
I was so, that story, you know, just, and it's folklore, right?
Yes.
I think it's a traditional tale, the Green Ribbon.
Yes, yeah. It that didn't have quite the same source material that, you know, to some degree, Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark. Those books had those kind of lengthy source materials in the back of the books that actually got thicker and thicker as the series went on.
Yes.
Because, you know, I think that was Alvin Schwartz's, you know, general interest was, you know, the folklore aspect. So he kind of, you know, went into more and more depth. And that was one of the things I remember the most, partially because you just didn't see that. It's like, you know, it kind of respected kids enough to say, hey, you know, here's a scary story. Great. You know, a lot of kids are naturally interested in that. But for other kids who really want to delve into it, here's all this source material. You can, you know, this story connects to this country from this, you know, this time frame, and it deals with these themes. You know, one of the stories that comes up often is the story of Harold, right? The scarecrow doll type thing that comes alive and does bad things, right? You know, in the source material, it's like, okay, this is similar to Frankenstein, right? This is similar to the golem of Jewish tradition and that sort of thing. I mean, you know, even though I'm imparting this scary story about, you know, some murderous character named Harold, you know, it has connections to all these other stories that are very traditional. And I distinctly remember moving on to Frankenstein. I read Frankenstein, the original Frankenstein, Mary Shelley, shortly after reading these books because, okay, this is a classic and it's also scary and, you know, and it's beautiful. So, you know, it was very advanced for that for my age, but I loved it, you know. I mean, the source material was one of those things that, like, me being kind of the nerdy bookish type, that's one of the things I kind of distinctly remember and opened my eyes a little bit.
You know, in the documentary, there was the whole, you know, talking about the challenge that the librarian actually used the source material as a justification for why she should keep some of these collections on the shelf. That was part of her argument, was that, you know, these folklores represent, you know, different cultures and different, you know, so that there's nothing else in my collection. You can say there are 10,000 books in the library, but these are the only books that actually, you know, fill that sort of void.
And I tried also, you know, when I did my discussion, when I used to read them at the end of the summer, I brought that in. Like, I'd always, you know, like, and I felt like it developed some critical thinking in the children. I'd be like, okay, so we have these stories about people, like you have the viper and the babysitter, like calling on the phone, you know, why... And of course now, you know, they're just like, oh, well, why didn't she just look up who called? But I'd be like, okay, so when do you think these, you know, stories would come about? And they're just like, oh, when everybody had a telephone in there, you know, because of course, like now you're just like, oh, he's calling from inside the house. Everyone's got their cell phone on them. Like, you can call your friend from inside the house.
It's not the same scary.
it's different. But the kids did like that.
And
they liked
these stories.
Source.
I mean, yeah, I mean, so many of the stories, you know, you can look at when they originated, and you can look at the fears that are kind of innate in the story, and it tells you a bit. I mean, some of them have to do with, you know, the guy with the hook, which, you know, everyone knows that, you know, it kind of had a life of its own outside of Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark, but you can look at stories like that. And, okay, when did it, come up? Well, it came up in the 50s and 60s when teenagers were just starting to get cars and
go park.
And, you know, make out and so on and so forth.
Overlook
so, okay, let's make up a guy with a hook who's going to come for you if you go park at Lover's Lane and that sort of thing. And a number of other stories have to do with, you know, the guy in the back seat.
Yes,
right?
That's a good one. And there's been so many variations of that.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes, but it also touches on, okay, when did it come about? It was at a time when more and more young people were driving, and we need to, you know, let's make up some stories that, you know, they're urban legends and they oftentimes didn't happen or never happened quite in that way. But, you know, let's add an element of fear to the fact that, you know, so people will be a little more cautious, and that's what a lot of these are, cautionary tales. You know, Hansel and Gretel, you know, of course, is a cautionary, very classic cautionary tale about, you know, trusting strangers and stuff. So there's no real difference between these and a lot of Grimm's fairy tales that have become a huge part of our culture.
You've even got something like Oh, Susanna in the books, which is one of those college tales, you know, going away to college mm-hmm. and being in a dorm. And I remember so many, you know, stories about, you know, like the roommate who ended up murdered and they were in your room the whole time, or there were stories circulating. I know Sharon and I went to college around the same time, you know, about how, somebody just saw on Oprah that a psychic predicted there's going to be a mass murder at a college dorm that looks like the letter H. And like almost every college dorm that was built around the same, you know, had similar structures. So, of course, everybody automatically thought it was their college. But in the Oh, Susanna story, would you like to talk a little bit about that one?
Sure. Yeah. So, Oh, Susanna, it's one of those stories that, it definitely had a little bit of a life before Scary Stories to Tell in Dark, but it was this particular book series introduced a lot of kids to that particular story, right? You know, there's the college student who comes back to their class, to their dorm room with their roommate. The roommate's asleep. So they go ahead and go to sleep, and they keep humming Oh, Susanna, throughout the night, and they keep saying, hey, shut up, whatever, just go to sleep, you know, so on and so forth, and find out in the morning, you know, their roommate has been killed, and oh gosh, I in some way where, like, there's no way they could have been humming Oh, Susanna, they must have been dead the whole time type of thing. There's a variation of it that Alvin Schwartz, I believe, mentions, and I always think of as the variation where someone is licking your hand. Your hand is off on the side of the bed, and someone keeps licking it.
That's a really scary one. Dog. Yeah.
Licking hand, and it turns out to be, I don't know, a homicidal maniac or something licking their hand or something. There's variations of it, but there's all kinds of those urban legends. Okay, we're going to send our kid to college. We need to arm them with some stories to guard them and make sure they're going to, you know, take care of themselves. So here's some urban legends and so on and so forth, and they get passed around. And in fact, Oh, Susanna is one of those where I remember the illustration distinctly from these books, partially because it had nothing to do with the story. And that's an interesting aspect. And I felt like Stephen Gamble, like, got more and more comfortable with illustrating these books. So throughout the series, he got a little more and more crazy with, you know, I say crazy, I mean, they're beautiful, but they're more and more surreal, I guess you could say. And Susanna one's a good example.
I can't actually divorce his other illustrations from, like, when he did other books now from these, because even though they're colorful and they're less terrifying, his style is so distinct. We're also talking a little bit about what our favorite books in the, what our favorite stories in the series are. I know Sharon was...
Yeah, it's funny. You were talking about the illustrations. I was flipping through that wonderful sausage illustration where the hand is eating from its arm, and just getting myself kind of grossed out. But as far as the stories themselves, I always that Room for One More. That one, it begins with the elevator.
Oh, and they and there's then, a Twilight Zone version of that one too, which is one of my favorite episodes. The Room for One More. Yeah.
Yeah. Is it actually? Wait. Does it start with? I know it, there's an elevator in it, but I think it actually was a car ride it begins with, and they're trying to, you know, the guy's face is all the sunken eyes.
He wakes up in the middle of the night and he thinks he sees a hearse.
Oh, is that
what are we have the books in front of us, Cody, but if you would like to,
help us out here. Do you remember that one in particular? I just remember the elevator part of that where it's like, you know, he decides not to take that elevator. And
because the operator of the, the operator of the elevator looks like the operator of the hearse from his dream. And then it turns out that the elevator crashes and everybody on the elevator dies. So it was like a prophetic dream.
Right, that one creeped me out a lot, and that I don't know. Did you have a favorite when you were either of you? Or?
Oh, Megan,
I'm just Aaron Kelly's Bones as a kid. That one really freaked me out because now as an adult, I'm thinking that's very much like almost like the monkey's paw, with the dead body coming back and not realizing that they're dead. And I just think that that was a really just creepy image in the beginning of that with the person with their bones falling off and their limbs falling off. So as a kid, that definitely creeped me out a lot.
And for me...
Yeah, one thing my experience has been an interesting one because what I found is, so there's over 80 stories, a few songs, but mostly stories, short stories. You know, what I found is when I get people talking about these books, they immediately jump to one or two or three of the ones that really, you know, they remember, they created a fear, lifelong fear to some degree, or a scenario always happens and they always think of that. If someone flashes the car lights behind them, they immediately think of the story where the killer's in the back seat. Sort of thing, so on and so forth. They have these things that happen in their life and they immediately think of one of these stories. But the interesting thing I found is that there's no one or two stories that everyone remembers the most. Not really. That was a bit of a challenge for me because, okay, how am I going to do a documentary and kind of touch on a number of these stories when there's over 80 of them? I'm not going to be able to, you know, delve into every single one. So we kind of had to, you know, do the best we could for sure. But there's a lot of them, right? And different people had different experiences really being affected by a lot of them. And it is, like I said, it's not just two or three that everyone remembers. There's at least a dozen, two dozen that, you know, people very fondly remember as, okay, this story stuck with me.
You know which one I always loved, and it has a really interesting history, and it's been, I don't know if it's hearsay on the internet or if it's been confirmed, but The Drum, I've heard rumors that it influenced Neil Gaiman to write Coraline, and that's the one where the two girls meet the gypsy girl in the middle of the field playing this extraordinary drum, and she convinces them to be bad. And her mother, yes.
The Other Mother is another way of putting it.
Yes, Lucy Clifford, I think wrote Gaiman. That. Yeah, it was the original cautionary tale from Victorian times. But go on, you were saying Neil Gaiman.
Yeah. So he credits The Other Mother, which is essentially another variation of The Drum. But yes, it's definitely one of those cautionary tales, you know, a setup somewhat similar to Hansel and Gretel, where, you know, you've got oftentimes a brother and sister going to town and they meet. In this case, in the story of The Drum and Scary Stories to Tell in Dark, it's a gypsy girl. And, one thing we kind of delved into in the documentary that we didn't talk specifically about this story, but it's definitely one that kind of we did touch on it a little, but kind of reinforces this idea. Okay, why is it a gypsy girl?
Exactly,
right?
Like outsiders are dangerous, and that type of I think in the documentary you talked about the Mexican pet, but go ahead. Sorry.
Yes. Yeah. So many of these stories is oftentimes kids or just people in general going somewhere they're not familiar with, or someone new is coming to town, and that's scary, right? They're unusual. You know, in some cases we touch on it was during shortly after the Civil War, so it's a North and South thing, right? Okay, some people coming from the South, and they could be our enemy, that sort of thing. Other times it's someone from a foreign land, right? The Mexican hairless is a good example of an innate fear of people coming from Mexico, basically, right? Which isn't at all pertinent to our current discussion.
Right, of course. No, but it is true that it was very clear that it was a gypsy girl, and it was always unclear as to whether or not she knew that the other mother was going to come. But honestly, what really scared me about the book was just that their mother was replaced by this horrifying being with glass eyes and a wooden tail, which literally makes no sense. Whenever I read that one to the kids, and I always, sometimes I'd skip around and then I'd find some other stories. But whenever that was like, they loved that one, and the Green Ribbon were the ones they always wanted to hear, but because they just kind of were scary in a sense that there was really no explanation. Like, why glass eyes and a wooden tail?
Sure. An interesting thing about that is, I've gone back and read the source material, the original or a previous version of that story, one of the ones that's credited often, and it goes on. Like
the mother actually interacts with them in that one, right? In this one, she's just there, but in the original,
yes, exactly. I mean, and it is something to be said for it being particularly effective because it stops there, right? They get home and their mother has been replaced by this creature, their other mother, their, so on and so forth. And it just kind of ends. And there's something, you could argue it's pretty effective because it ends there, right?
Her wooden tail is thumping against the floor, and there's always like that, you can add that little, if you're telling the story, you can add that little thump, thump, thump with your hand. But I do think, what do you guys think about ending a story at the...
There's that whole section of those like jump stories or like the ones that, that have that like sudden kind of ending. And I think those are so great for story time. I mean, like, it's this built in scary ending that just, gets the kids jumping out of their skins, which is so fun. So I really like those.
And I think it's great because it furthers your imagination. It makes you think like you can make your own interpretation of the ending and you can discuss it with your friends, because we used to discuss these books all the time and what we thought happened. So.
And with again, it's one of Alvin Schwartz's younger books, but with the Green Ribbon, like it just ends. Her head fell off. Like she takes off the ribbon and her head fell off. The end. Like,
you can't argue with that.
You can't argue with that. And everybody's like, "What?"
Yeah, the catching you by surprise.
And it's such a simplistic, like that. Just it's so fitting for kids because. Like they, someone's head falling off is something that just like it's not overly complicated. It's effective, and it's something a kid can visualize, and it's something that I can imagine a kid talking about. You get heads gonna fall off, I mean, it's perfect for kids because it talks to them in a way that.
Megan and I actually know somebody who has cosplayed at Comic-Con as Jenny from The Green Ribbon.
That's great. I was going to say, did you ever use it as a prop? Like, do you ever show up to story time with a green ribbon?
No, but I should. Oh my God. Why did I never think of that? I think,
like, don't mention it. You know?
Just be like, and by the way, but I did see a meme online about a month ago where it was something like, you don't marry for love. You don't marry for money. You marry to find out if the green ribbon around her neck is going to cause her head to come off.
That's great.
So it's real.
One of the stories. Oh. Go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, I mean, one of the stories has kind of grown to be one of my favorites is the first story from the first book that many people remember fondly, which is The Big Toe, which is It's synonymous with the Golden Arm story. It basically, if you look it up, you'll quickly see that there's a whole tradition of the Golden Arm stories. It's become a trope, you know, and it's been done. You know, you can vary it up in all kinds of different ways. The Big Toe is just one iteration of it, but it's become, because of Scary Stories to Tell in Dark, become probably the most told version of the Golden Arm, you know, tale. This is, you know, a kid comes across a toe sticking out of the ground, and he pulls it out.
Because that's what you do.
Oh, definitely.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, of course you would do that. And you take it home, and of course, what would you do? You would cook it and serve it up for dinner.
Yum, yum.
And so they eat it. They eat the toe, which is... it's silly and kind of, you know, definitely Grimm's fairy tales ish. Like, okay, this just seems like a silly thing you would tell to, you know, a kid. But also, an undercurrent there is like, okay, you know, farmers at a certain time, they would, you know, forage and they would eat whatever they could come up with, right? Because, you know, their means probably weren't ideal and so on and so forth. Anyways, so they cook it up and eat it, the toe, and that night, you know, a voice comes, who's got my toe? And it gets closer and closer, and it's a, you know, and at the end, yes, it's that jump scare. You got it, you know? Mm-hmm. And this one in particular became part of its appeal or popularity came from actually Mark Twain. Mark Twain used the Golden Arm story as he would go around from campus to campus and kind of use and wrote about the fact that this story was a good example of how important it is how you tell a story, right? The way I just told it, it wasn't great because I was just kind of telling it. But if you're a good storyteller, you know, you can turn that simple tale and it can be the scariest thing in the world because you're going to incorporate, you know, okay, this happened to my cousin who lives, you know, in the town next. You remember this person, so on? It's their cousin. You start incorporating
The friend of the friend folklore, yes, which, yes.
Exactly. And you build it up. And how you tell it is the most important thing to that story because you're gonna you know, add the suspense and you're going to build it up and so on. And then there's that, you know, release at the end. You've got it. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's kind of become one of my favorites, partially because I like the idea that, okay, you know, it's not just what happens in the story, it's how you tell it.
I think there was in the documentary, they talk about children hiding these books when they took them home. because I guess they did, they might have thought that these were not things that their parents would be happy with them reading. How did it feel to interview the people, including Alvin Schwartz's son, who were central to the whole kerfuffle of trying to ban these books?
So it was an interesting experience for sure. I mean, some of the things were on the easy side, which is to say, you know, this is a popular book series, and it wasn't that difficult to get people talking about these books, and, you know, and even getting scholars and folklorists, you know, they get it, right? Mm-hmm. They get that, okay, yes, these are just scary tales for kids, but there's a lot of benefit to them, and they're an introduction to all kinds of things that, you know, benefit kids if they, you know, delve deeper into, you know, the stories that are in the books and that sort of thing. So some of those were, but yes, the you know, the censorship piece was, oh gosh, yeah, it was, you know, what I ended up doing, although it was interesting to kind of look at a number of different cases of, you know, these books being, you know, challenged and that sort of thing. What I ended up doing was, okay, you know, it's not enough just to, you know, mention that it was challenged in this school or that school and that sort of thing. You know, I wanted to find a particular case that, you know, made national attention, and let's delve into that, you know. And and it just so happened it was in the Seattle area, and Peter Schwartz, son of Alvin Schwartz, he lives in the Seattle area. So that just became a really great opportunity to say, okay, let's delve into that case, and let's find the person who, you know, was the at the forefront of that. And in fact, you know, there was a big piece in New York Times when Alan Schwartz passed away back in the early 90s, and she was quoted in that, you know, this it was a very – if you Google Alan Schwartz, one of the first things you're going to come across is this big New York Times article just after he passed. Who is Alan Schwartz and why do, you know, people want to ban his books, right? And she at that time was the most prominent person, you know, getting on talk shows and, you know, railing against, you know, these books aren't appropriate, so on and so forth. So I tracked her down, and it wasn't that easy because her name had changed and she'd moved and so on and so forth. But, you know,
is that because of the national attention that her name had changed? Or
people ask me, you know, what's the number one reason why these books were challenged? And certainly there's aspects of, okay, the illustrations were, you know, were easily, you know, you could point to certainly specific things that happen in stories that had violence and that sort of thing. Yes, all that were factors. But I would say the number one reason is they were popular. They were wildly popular, and kids wanted to. You talk about kids, you know, hiding them under the, you know, covers and that sort of thing. Yes, that's a perfect demonstration of the fact that kids wanted to read these books, and they were, you know, they were being passed around and talked about. These books aren't on the top 10 list as much anymore, mostly because, you know, they were published so long ago, and so there's other books that take that, but it's always books that happen to be the most popular. You know, Harry Potter, you know, that's often a tops on the list. One of my son's favorite is Captain Underpants. It's usually one of the top ones nowadays, and it wouldn't be if they weren't incredibly popular. My kid loves those books, you know? And so, you know, I think popularity is oftentimes the number one reason, right? I mean, yes, you can point to, you know, things that are in those books that are the cause of the challenges, but no one would notice if they weren't popular.
Go ahead, Megan.
So when I was a kid, I didn't really feel like I had to hide the books, but they were always like in my backpack if I needed to reference them. And I did notice that the kids, what they did do was earmark some of the pages of their favorite stories many times. And one of those stories, which I really like, is The Viper. Mm-hmm. I just think it's great. Like, it's got humor, horror, and it's just like the whole Dracula feel to it. I want to wipe the windows. And yeah, I guess with the whole telephone situation, the kids today would maybe question that. But
they still love it, though. I will say, I mean, they do a little bit, but they still love it. And but Bloody Fingers is another one that's got kind of a little bit of humor in it with the ghost.
Yeah,
the,
and, yeah. And that's, you know, the ones that have humor in it, I don't know. I would hear a number of people that, you know, those were the ones they remember the most were the ones that ended up with kind of a jokey thing. It was actually a minority of the stories. Like, there were only a handful of them.
I can't think of another one other than those two.
Yeah. Those are definitely a couple of the more prominent ones. I usually think of The Viper as Wait Until Martin Comes.
Oh, my husband is terrified of that one. He thinks it's the scariest one.
Yeah. I mean, and that's, I think it ends something along the lines of, you wait here for him, I'm getting out of here type thing. there's a number of those that if you put it in amongst all these other stories that are definitely more on the scary side, okay, let's give you one that's just a jokey, you know, thing. It's a nice, it mixes the stories up.
Exactly. There's also one of the ones I always thought was really scary was the dream where the woman, she's an artist and she's going to go to, she's, you know, traveling and she's going to go someplace and has a bad dream about the hotel she's going to stay in. So she goes to a different place, but that place is actually the hotel where the scary things happen. And again, it's one of the ones that just ends, you know, when it gets to that point, which leaves so much more to the imagination. But I remember when I was doing that story recently, I think like 2 summers ago, because it takes place in upstate New York. Now, was Alvin Schwartz from this area?
New Jersey. The Princeton area, and I traveled there and kind of visited. So yes, he would have known the New Jersey / New York area pretty well. But he also traveled and so, you know, he definitely tried to incorporate stories from you know, all over the place and liked to kind of, you know, get different, you know, different stories from different lands, essentially.
Because I remember I was reading it and I was traveling up to a wedding near Kingston. And I'm like, oh, I'm staying in Kingston. Like, you know, even like in my 30s, be like, yeah, that's a little creepy. And I know this is totally fiction, but I'm still creeped out by this.
But is it really totally fiction?
Well, that's, yeah, I mean, you know, folklore in general, you know, it comes from word of mouth, I guess. I don't know. Folklore isn't considered, it's not cataloged in the fiction section.
No, a little librarian.
Yeah.
You put it with nonfiction.
One of the reasons why I still would come back to these books, even as an adult, is the whole folklore aspect and how we can, it's a way to root us back to our past. And just the horror genre in general is something that I, you know, I connect with, and I think it connects people of all ages. So I think it's not harmful to kids. I think it is helpful for them, and it keeps you talking.
And it keeps you thinking.
Yeah, I mean, what I tend to think about is the fact that, you know, adults are interested in the horror genre, but if I could ask any single one of them, where did that love begin? It started in childhood, right? That it's just kind of naturally when we start to, you know, challenge ourselves with scarier and scarier things, right? My son, who is about to turn 9 years old, he's still like, he's not much for the scary stuff, right?
Yeah,
yeah, exactly. Has no interest. It's superheroes. It's Pokemon and all that stuff. You know, anything that's too scary, he's not for it, which is perfectly fine, right? You know, you challenge them in little ways, but generally speaking, if they're not interested in scary stuff at that point, great. They may never get interested in scary stuff, and that's perfectly fine too, right? The tricky part of it is, okay, my kid isn't interested in scary stories. Now I'm going to go to his elementary school. Am I going to, you know, keep it out of the entire library so that, you know, other kids that maybe would be interested don't have the same access to these books? No, I wouldn't do that. So, you know, the joke I sometimes say is we live in a society, right? So we live in a society and we're sending all our kids to a lot of the same, you know, these same public schools and so on. So we have to come up with, you know, really we need to have a discussion on, okay, how do we monitor these things? Because we're all, you know, parents and we all have different comfort levels and so on and so forth. But, you know, we have to send our kids to the same school. So, you know, what I tend to, you know, who I respect is the librarians who are in the middle of this and have to deal with things are on the front lines. And they're the ones that have to initially deal with parents oftentimes. And, you know, it varies how prepared they are for these types of issues when they come. And oftentimes the American Library Association says it just kind of quietly happens, right? You know, a parent has a problem with a book a certain amount of time, it's just quietly taken off the shelves without any discussion. And that's what I think I'm pointing to is the fact that there's a problem there, right? There's no discussion being had. And oftentimes it's a book that, you know, has a lot of, you know,
people can find something about almost any book, honestly. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, there's some, like, if you look at the banned list, I mean, we've all done that,
yeah,
right?
There are absurd reasons throughout, you know.
Yeah, like everything from talking animals aren't appropriate to, like, it could be,
you
like,
know,
the
cult,
most... Cult, you know, it could be the most innocent book about a character who's a witch, and they're like, it's witchcraft, it's, you know, like, oh, it's and it's just like, really? Because, like, it's really the sweetest, most innocent book on the face of the planet, mm-hmm. and, like, you're, what? So really, I mean, there's really, anybody can find a reason to challenge a book for any reason.
Right. That's why it's so important to have some sort of policy and, steps to take when that happens. Yeah.
One story that didn't quite make the cut of the documentary, but I thought it was interesting and poignant is, you know, a librarian who talked about this a particular time where a parent was, you know, volunteering in the library, like happens all the time, but that sort of thing. And a parent just started collecting all these books, you know, making a pile that were going to be, you know, donated or given away or out of the library, incinerated, who knows. But, you know, started making a pile of books to get rid of, and there were any books that had a witch in it. Like, okay, you know, it's not appropriate for any story to have a witch in it because that has to do with witchcraft.
Which,
right?
I think is Harry
and
Potter,
think
like,
of all
over and over again is what people complain about in Harry Potter.
Yes. Yeah. That's one of
And, you know, a good example, you know, a book that, you know, I think of, a recent one would be Room on the Broom, which is, you know, this, you know, has won awards and so on.
My
so
boys
forth, that, yes, it has
love
a witch on it.
Room on the Broom. They love it.
And there's a lot of really great concepts going on in that one simple story of these animals kind of getting on this broom and is their room. And I mean, it's mathematical. It has to do with, all kinds of concepts that you can kind of introduce at a young age in a really well done children's book. But yes, it has a witch in it.
And
so,
she's kind.
So,
she encourages the animals to make room on the broom so they can all fly together, and then in the end they do her a good turn. It's really there's also an animation I think that's been on Netflix. I think Gillian Anderson might have a lot. There's a lot of voices in it. What's his name from Shaun of the Dead? Simon Pegg has a voice in it.
Really?
Yeah. But that's interesting. I didn't know that Room on the Broom was causing a stir, pun intended.
Well, I mean, if you're going to toss any story that has a witch in it, well, then you're taking away, you know, what I consider one of the more popular and useful, interesting books to introduce, yes, around Halloween time when kids are naturally talking about it, but has a lot of great concepts that you can kind of pull out and get kids introduced to, you know.
So we're getting close to wrapping. So does anybody have anything they want to add, Megan or Sharon?
I just, real quick, there was a section in the documentary where they showed the woman who was getting the sleeve of tattoos and, you know, the artwork. And there was just such an interesting fandom to see in the documentary. I just the collection of people you brought together and were able to get interviews and clips from. I enjoyed seeing that. That was really cool.
Art gallery where they made like 3D images of
3D,
Steve Gabel's.
There's so much to talk about. But yes. I mean, really, you did a wonderful job of mixing, you know, the stories with the images and bringing it all to life. And the 3D images and the tattoos. It was visually stunning. It was really cool to see. So I just wanted to thank you for that because I really enjoyed it.
And I really
thanks.
I really appreciated in the documentary that you took a very critical analysis. You had people on both sides of the issue, so it wasn't just people that beloved the books. Like there was topic for discussion, and I think that was great.
Do you have any thoughts about the upcoming feature film?
I think it looks great. I mean, I love the people involved. I've actually been in a little contact with the director and stuff. And, you know, I think it's, what I would say is whether you're doing a documentary or an adaptation of the books, it's a tricky thing no matter what, right? It's a nostalgia title. And so I respect people even taking a crack at it because it's tricky. And again, I'd say it's over 80 stories. You're not going to touch on every single one. So I think, you know, I've been impressed with, okay, you know, they're keeping it scary. It's going to be, you know, the trailers look, they're
Harold,
like,
yeah, Harold, I think really one of our friends said, Harold, heck no, just no, nope in the heck out of there. is it Guillermo del Toro? He really he makes monsters an art, which the original artwork.
Right. It just seems like a really great marriage of images and imagery.
Whether or not
And keeping it practical. I mean, I'm a fan of that when they can, you know, keep it looking like you can reach out and touch it type stuff.
Or Harold's going to reach out and touch you.
Yep.
Yeah, and I thought it was one last thing about the illustrations. I was unaware that Stephen Gamel was so private. Is he still of our world?
Yes. Yeah, kind of a long story, but yes, he kind of, you know, and I've uncovered a certain amount, and what I have in the documentary is an interview he did a long time ago. But generally speaking, the last 30 years, you know, he has kind of wanted his art to speak for itself, sort of thing. And I had some indirect contact with him and that sort of thing.
It speaks volumes.
It screams. Oh, thank you so much, Cody. This has been absolutely wonderful.
Thank you. Yeah.
And everybody who's listening, I urge you to check out the documentary. Once again, what's it called? Where can it be found? When will it be on DVD?
So, Scary Stories. You can find it. It's on all the major VOD platforms right now, and the DVD is available for pre-order on Amazon right now, and it comes out July 16th. But you can stream it right now if you get on one of your more popular VOD platforms. And yeah,
very cool.
Very cool, Cody. Thank you so much. And we are going to close.
Thank you.
We're going to close this chapter of Turn the Page.
It's time to close this chapter of Turn the Page. Join us for the next episode.